Women have come a long way in many places, but not as far as they'd like, or as far as would be good for the societies in which they live. Even in the United States, women still make 80 cents on the dollar, on average, of what men make. Some of that is due to flat-out gender discrimination. Some comes from women who start out high-powered and highly educated, but need to step back at times to have kids or take care of elderly parents or other family emergencies. More often than not, women are still the glue that holds a family together, and the work they do to make that happen is not always adequately valued, not in monetary terms, not in terms of women's place in society. And if that's true in the United States, it's doubly true in parts of the Middle East. The interesting thing is, though, that throughout the Middle East these days, more women than men are getting a college education. But, according to the Brookings Institution, 3 out of 4 women in the Middle East are out of the workforce. And of young women actively seeking work, 44% are unemployed, almost double the rate for young men. So, given all this, I've been mulling over, what would it take for this to be the Middle East century? Can it even happen when half the region's population is being held back? This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstad. So, what about that question? Can the Middle East thrive in this century if women are held back in the workforce, or even held back from the workforce?
I think this is a major loss for the region.
This is my colleague Shirin Jafari from the radio program The World.
These countries invest a lot in educating these women, but then it's not reaping the success of these women after they graduate. And these women, they're so hungry to contribute to the society, and it's a shame to not use that talent, to not use that energy.
Shirin has seen some of these challenges up close.
I was born in Iran and I grew up in Iran. And so I have an interest generally about issues from the Middle East, but then also being a woman from the Middle East, I'm particularly interested in, you know, how women live their lives over there. What are the issues that concern them? What are the challenges they face?
And the challenges faced by educated women in the workforce hits close to home.
I can maybe talk about my own sister. She has a PhD in ancient languages, and she has been looking for a permanent job for years. So she's been looking into finding a job in the public universities. And the answer she's been getting is that she lost, for example, a position to a guy simply because he's married and he's supporting a family. And she's not. She's not married. She's not supporting a family.
If that all sounds a little familiar, just go back and watch a couple of episodes of Mad Men to remind yourself how recently American women were dealing with a similar strain of blatant sexism. In the Middle East, there's a wide range of experience for women. Saudi Arabia is famous for not letting women drive and for expecting women to cover up everything but their eyes when they're out in public, lest they tempt men. But then there's Jordan, which is often seen as one of the safest and most tolerant majority Muslim countries in the Middle East. It has 95% female literacy and one of the region's highest rates of female university education. But Jordan's got other issues, like a huge refugee population. Syrians have come most recently, Palestinians before. 1 in 3 of Jordan's 10 million people are refugees or non-citizen immigrants. This creates competition for jobs, and Jordan's economy hasn't been doing so well of late. What happens to women when there's competition for jobs? Well, in Jordan, it gets tougher. By some estimates, just 14 or 15% of Jordanian women are employed in the formal sector, though when you include informal work like running street stalls or selling clothes or something like that, it's more like 25%. And women who do work are paid on average about half of what men are. That means a lot of women are not working, and in many cases, it's not because they don't want to. Even though the Brookings Institution estimates that Jordan is missing out on up to a full percentage point of GDP growth by not having more women in the workforce. So why is this happening in a country where so many women get a decent education? In truth, Jordan is still pretty conservative when it comes to attitudes toward women. Honor killings, while still rare, are on the rise. Convicted rapists in Jordan were, until last year, allowed to sidestep punishment if they married their victims for at least 3 to 5 years. If Jordanian Muslim women want to marry non-Muslims, their marriage isn't recognized. And even if a Jordanian woman does marry a Muslim from another country, she can't pass on her nationality to her spouse and children. So my colleague Shirin Jafari recently visited Jordan, and she went to talk with someone who knows a thing or two about women there.
My name is Asma Khadr. I am a lawyer, and I am a human rights activist, women's rights activist. So I need to stop.
Yes,
please.
You're lucky.
Yeah, this is a very lucky.
It's tempting to call this a metaphor. The Islamic call to prayer stepping on a female rights activist's voice. And it's not the only time in this interview you'll hear music under Asma's voice at interesting moments. But this is really just a matter of the interview being done in her office, in the busy city of Amman, with thin windows. Asma's voice is still strong, and she's got a lot to say. So here she is, Asma Khadr, lawyer, women's rights activist, former president of the Jordanian Women's Union, former minister of state, and much more. She'll detail more of what she's done as we go along. Talking here about the challenges for women to have economic power in Jordan, in the workplace and at home.
For women, even if they are contributing to the economy of the family, the legal system is not really seeing them as contributors. So if she is divorced after 20 years, she will not be able to take anything of what she contributed to at home. Everything will be owned by the husband, and she will go without any benefits. So women are not benefiting now, they are not benefiting later, and they are working a lot. Sometimes in Egypt, they did a research. They found that a housewife is working 63 hours a week. A man who is working outside the home will work 52 hours a week. But he is owning everything and having control over everything. And if you ask her children, is your mother working? They will say, no, she's at home. And if she wants to go to work and she has two children, she need to pay 200 jadis for the kindergarten for them. And if the salary is 300, the rest 100 she needs them for the transportation. So why bother? Why go and run and become very tired, feeling guilty because you are not doing either one of them the best way? So they decided not to go to work. So I think it needs a lot of work to encourage women to be economically independent and to be really willing to work and controlling the income of their work. Of course, I'm not saying that they should not participate in the family responsibility, but I think always responsibilities should be balanced with the rights in the same time.
In comparison to the neighboring countries and also in the region in general, where does Jordan stand in terms of female employment?
Employment, we are not in a good position. Many other Arab countries, in Lebanon, they are in better situation, and even in Syria before the war, even in Egypt. We are one of the lowest rates of women employment. Even women economic empowerment generally. If you look to the number of women who are owning property, like apartments or lands, you will find them not more than 15%. So you can see that there is a real imbalance situation. Economically, Saudi Arabia women and the Gulf States women are really owning a lot. They are economically very empowered. They have property in their name. They have their own businesses very clearly. But of course, in Jordan, Jordanian women are very empowered in terms of education. They are one of the best in the region.
That was actually very surprising to me. Women outnumber men in the education system, in higher education. But then when it comes to employment, it seems like Jordan is not being able to put into use the degrees.
They invest in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where do you think the problem stems from?
I describe it to you. Yeah. First of all, we have a very high rate of unemployment generally. There are many aspects. One of them is that in Jordan, we have nearly 1 million foreign workers. But we have around 700,000 unemployment only. So you can see, if the Jordanian men and women are ready to do the things that the foreigners are doing in the country, then we don't have the problem. This is one thing. There is the culture, there is the sitting behind desks with, you know, and not doing things like infrastructure or...
Yeah, meaning if I have a degree, I don't want to go do construction work.
They call it shame feelings, but it is not only shame. It is also the prestigious of a person. This is one thing. Also, culture and tradition forbidden many women to occupy jobs that are not close to their houses or to their homes, that will oblige them to leave the, for example, the village to the city or the city to another city, to move around alone. Most of the families, for their daughters or their wives, they want them to be working in a school close to the house. And this is not available all the time. They don't want them to work in places where foreign men are there. So this is another reason, cultural reason. I think this is problematic. The other thing is the economy, the salaries and the benefits that a woman will gain from being a working woman. And in my opinion, it is not encouraging. The conditions are not encouraging women to work. Of course, I know and everybody knows that there are a lot of informal productivity going on, but it is not counted. Many women are working from home, preparing food, selling clothes, doing this, doing that, but it is not registered. Nobody know about it. We did a survey 7 years ago in Amman, Greater Amman, and we found the percentage of women in the labor market was 12.8 that year. But we found that if we take into account the informal sector, it will become 25%. So that means tens of women, thousands of women are working from home without being registered.
And without being registered means there's no insurance, there's no benefits.
No insurance, no benefits, no social security, no income taxes are collected. So there are a lot of problems related to this. But I think they choose it because of the traditional culture. They are at home.
So you also mentioned an interesting point that I want to pick up on, childcare. I mean, this is a big burden on women.
Yeah, of course. In the few years ago, the expanded family was helping women. For example, my mother helping me a lot to be able to be a lawyer and spend the whole day in the courts and the office. So I succeed to be a lawyer. But I had 4 children. Without my mother, it would be so difficult to pay for 4 children in the schools and kindergartens at once. Many other families have the same help by mother or mother-in-law or somebody within the family. These days, the nuclear families, husband, wife, and children, is the model. So expanded families are not anymore in a position to provide any help. I am a grandmother, but I am still working the full day. I cannot give my daughter children any time to take care of them. So life became different. And my daughter stayed at home for 3 years when she had her babies small. And she continued to work after they became an age to go to school.
What does she
do? She's teaching now. And she decided to go to this type of job because she needs the discount for teachers for their children in the school, because it is very high cost. So, you know, economy is controlling decisions. The choices are not really free for women. She is not free enough to say, this is what I love to do. And this is a problem, because you are not in love with what you are doing. In the first challenge you face, you will leave.
So my assumption is that women want to work and are
women
interested
to work.
Is that true?
It has to be a decent work. It has to be a work that are helping them economically. They should gain support, financial good income, social security that is really helping them in the future. They need to have a new distribution of duties at home between them and their husbands or their brothers if they are not married. There are many, many things need to be changed. They should not be under suspicion when they move in the streets or speak to colleagues or, you know, the society is surrounding them with questions, with suspicion, until you prove that you are innocent. So it is a very difficult life. I want to prove why I talked to him, why he called me by phone, why I was late a little bit in the office. Always you are under questioning. In the family, by even the neighbors. If you came back home late in the evening, everybody will, where she was, what she was doing. you know, this type of culture is really very difficult for a woman to feel relaxed and free to do whatever she believed and she had to do. So it is really very culturally controlled and there is a huge pressure. So for a wise person, I may say I'll stay home and enjoy my life. My husband is obliged to spend money to fund me. You know, this is the law.
Right. So but what are the consequences of not having women in the workforce? What is Jordan missing out?
They have of the manpower or human power in the country, because Jordan's main treasure is the human resources. And especially with the investment in educating women, we spent a lot of the national income in building schools and universities and all of this. So the country invests in women, but they are not getting back anything. So development and confronting the economic challenges need all the talent, all the efforts, all the work power to be in place.
What's interesting to me is that so it is okay, for example, for a younger woman to go out like to university and, you know, school, that's fine. Because it's at the same time, if you think about it, they're going out of the house. You know, they're spending time in an environment that might not be culturally, you know, 100% okay with the family.
It became very conservative. Even the environment of the university, 2-3 decades ago, it was full of the informal activities. It was full of the cultural activities. These days, it is really very conservative. And there are university students who are acting as if they are still in the secondary school in the village. Their minds is still very narrow, very closed, very controlled as well. Like many girls were ordered to stop going to the university because somebody told the brother or the father that your daughter was talking to somebody in the university. So there is this, the whole fundamental religious practices that was growing in this region the last few years. It has an impact, social impact, cultural impact, that we are easily recognized in the universities, in the public places, in the work environment as well. So you can easily see that, for example, there was some advertisement by some governmental institutions, nearly 20 job opportunities. They put very clearly and openly, we need accountant, we need IT, we need this, we need that. He should be a man. Male. So it is clearly a trend of more conservative employment policies. That was not, in my opinion, the case a few years ago.
That's interesting. I was talking to somebody about this and she told me, a Jordanian woman, and she said, you know, I talked to this girl and she told me that if you talk to my family, my dad is okay with me working outside. But if you talk to my brother, who's younger, you would think that it's less conservative. He would say no.
Yeah. In many, look, there are differences. But the majority are very conservatives and very close-minded. And the new generation is a victim of the wrong messages that was distributed through the media, social media, even through the public speeches, especially by community leaders and religious leaders. And even in schools, the curricula and the teachers was educating them based on the very traditional way. It's shame your sister is doing this. It's shame your sister is doing that. So why bother? And somebody will blame him for what his sister is doing. Stay home. And you have the patriarchal power to say no. So they can create problems. Many girls were killed doing nothing, just having a mobile. One of them was killed just because she bought a mobile to speak.
Other killing you're talking about?
No, she was killed. Her brother said she bought the mobile to speak to her boyfriend without even having any evidence that she's talking to a boyfriend. Yeah.
And is this a Jordan-wide issue, or how is Amman different than other places in Jordan?
You cannot say other places. It depends on the level of education, level of economic situation, but it happened everywhere, even within the Christian community as well, within Christian families.
But do you see now a momentum within the community to change this? Do you see women, you know, voicing their concern or even the government paying more attention?
Look, it's a survival policy that we need all women and men to be in the workplace and to be productive and to contribute to the economy and to contribute to the public life and to be part of the development process, all of this. It's a must. The main challenge is how to balance between the very conservative mentality and patriarchal mentality that still exists and these new approaches and needs. Women now are more aware about their rights and responsibilities. But, you know, enjoying rights is a responsibility by itself. You need to pay some efforts if you want to enjoy your rights. So for many lazy or used to be lazy figures in the society, they prefer to stay home and not doing anything and live, enjoy their life. This luxury is not anymore possible. The life became very expensive, and one salary in the family is not enough, so everybody need to work, everybody need to have an income. And I think because of these elements, it is not the momentum now. It's very difficult now because of the refugee crisis, because of the economic crisis. All of these problems are not giving a good chance for quick changes. But in the meantime, the governmental policy, at least what they are saying, not necessarily what they are doing, but what they are saying, the speeches, are really encouraging women to participate, to be part of the economy. And everybody is mentioning that we have the main challenge is the percentage of women in the labor market. But even in the governmental sector, where the most of the working women are there, they are not opening necessarily kindergartens in the workplaces for women. So they are not doing what they should do. And I think until they realize that they need to take action to solve problems, it's not going to happen. I hope that they will recognize this is a must. And when they start having strategies and plans to deal with these challenges, with these problems, things will change, of course, especially because of the open communication possibilities these days. So women can be aware about how other women all over the world are living, how other Arab women in the region are doing, what we are missing, what are our rights, all of these things. And many women are very talented and they want to do something. Many will succeed and they can be a good role model to others. If the state was able to enforce the constitutional rights and the international conventions rights that Jordan ratified and all of this, this will help opening the way for women to enjoy equal rights.
Do you think there are enough laws in place in Jordan for women, you know, to get more women in the workplace? So you think it's not the law that's missing, it's the actual implementation and just the cultural side?
No, I think both, but laws are not so bad. They are good in a way. They need some amendments, of course, especially labor law and social security law and others. There was some amendments happened very newly and were very positive. Now, the state security, social security law will pay the maternity leave to the employer. In the past, he has to pay full maternity leave for women. So they were not really encouraged to have women, married women, or to keep women until they became pregnant. Now they are paying to the social security fund, and they would receive the salaries if a woman in the company get the maternity leave. So this will encourage all the companies to hire women. So there are some development happening. No guarantee for equal pay, which needs a law to be effective. No protection from sexual harassment in the workplace or the institutions, educational institutions, is in place. So there are some laws that need to be amended: penal code, labor law, social security law, family law as well. But in the meantime, the law is like a gate. If it is good, it will be an open gate for women to enter to their rights. But if the gate is closed and the society is not allowing you to go out, then it will be very complicated, very difficult. So we need the law, but it is not by itself enough. We need also to work hard on the mentality, on the culture, on the application of the law, on the implement of the law. We need more women judges everywhere. We have a huge campaign for raising minimum age of marriage. We did a campaign against honor crimes. We did a campaign against Article 308. And in all cases, the laws was amended partly, not fully.
Tell me about your own experience. You're a very successful woman in the Jordanian workforce.
I'm trying my best, but I cannot judge. I went through a very long experience in being involved in public life. I occupied many different positions, from being a lawyer to an activist in human rights issues, work with Amnesty International, with our Jordan Bar Association, with the Arab Lawyer Union, with the International Commission of Jurists, many different agencies, and then being elected to be the president of the Jordanian Women Union, and then to be a minister. I became the Jordanian National Commission for Women Secretary General for 8 years, and then occupied the vice president position for the Independent Election Commission in Jordan and a Senate in the 26th House of Senate, and many royal commissions, since the Royal Commission to draft the National Charter in 1989, to the Royal Committee of Human Rights and the National Center for Human Rights, then on the Board of Trustees, and many other agencies. But also I am a mother of four and grandmother of three. And I enjoyed so much to be a lawyer. I like this job, and I go and come back all the time to my base, which is the law office.
So you were a lawyer, and you know, you did all these amazing things. What was your experience like for you personally, going through those different positions? And
I gain a lot from all different experiences, but I'm still learning. There was some self-motivation related to me or my family. For example, I have my father's letter here, if you see it. This card was sent to me by my father when I was in my first year in the law school. And he is telling me how much he is imagining me a lawyer, successful lawyer, strong and defending the rights of the weakness people. And he passed away before I was graduated from the university. So he was a person who believed in me. That was really very, has a real impact. Also, my mother was a very helpful person. She took big part of my duties to help me with. My husband is a very open-minded person who never was a problem in my activism. And my children as well, they are proud and they are pushing me. To be frank, I realized the discrimination between men and women since I was 11. We have a habit in Jordan, they call the parents Abu and father of and mother of. They use the name of the biggest, older child, male child. But we were three daughters, so my father was Abu Asma, my name, for 11 years. But then my brother came. In 1 second, everybody shifted. So I was shocked. Everybody suddenly forget about me and start calling my parents with the name of this newborn boy who was even not able to speak. So I felt very bad, and I felt that maybe boys are better. So I start asking to cut my hair very short and to play in the street and refuse to help my mother at home. And then my father realized the changes, and he started talking to me about the society and about how much he is proud of me, and he is not discriminating, but the society is seeing this, and he cannot change the mind of everybody suddenly, but I should play a role with the open-minded people to change these things. So I start watching and realizing that my friends, for example, are not allowed to go to the cinema, not allowed to play football in the street. They are obliged to help their mothers in the kitchen, all of these things. And I start to be their lawyer since I was 12 years old, to negotiate in a tough way with their parents. So you should
Did
not
they listen to you?
They were listening. I was shouting.
You were 12 years old?
Yeah. For example, I organized a trip to the cinema with 10 girls. We went as a delegation to every family to encourage them to allow their daughter to come with us. And some were saying, no, you are just girls. You cannot go alone. And we make it. We did it because we stressed that it is our right. You allow the boys in our age to do that. And we are even braver than them to defend ourselves. So we did it. In the school as well, I played a role that time to be the girls' defender, talking to the director of the school and to the teachers. And the first time I was involved in public event was in 1964 or 5. There was a plane attack against part of Jordan that time by the Israeli aeroplanes. So we had demonstrations in the streets and I was on the shoulders of my friends shouting against them. And then three years, 1967, the West Bank was occupied and many people came to Jordan as refugees, new refugees. So I was volunteering to help in accommodating them and make sure that they have food and blankets.
How old were you?
I was 14. 14 nearly.
Amazing, for a 14-year-old. How did people react to you, like the father of that family? In fact,
it was not easy. I remember that some of our relatives were coming to my father, keep your daughter home. And he said, I have no boys to do the duty. And I can't trust her even if she is with 1,000 person. So he was defending all the time my position. And then when I finished the school, the secondary school, I decided to study law. And of course, there was no faculty of law in Jordan. So everybody was, what you are going to do with this? There is no job for you. Study some literature, something to be a teacher. But I stressed that I want to study law. And the nearest one was the Faculty of Law in Damascus. So I want to travel there and study in Damascus. And everybody was against this decision. Even my mother was worried a little bit. But my father said, no, she will go and she will study law. And I went to the Faculty of Law in Damascus. I was maybe, I think, the first one in the family to leave the family and go to study in other state.
What was it like going there? And what was it like when you first got there?
In fact, it was not easy. But always I had this feeling of being challenged and want to prove that a girl can do it. And I did it. But because my father was retired that time, was sick, so I have to work. I am the oldest one to help my mother and the family. So I was not able to get my trainee as a lawyer because this is a period that you are not paid for. So I work as a teacher for 3 years, and then I had a problem with with the director of the school because of the violence against children. She was beating them, and I was against beating children. So we have a confrontation, and she said, this is my school. If you are not happy, you can leave. So I went out. I resigned, and I start trying to find another job, and I work in the Al-Akhbar newspaper for 1 year. Then I get married, and my husband has a job in Saudi Arabia. So he is not here, so I am more free, and I have money. He has a good salary. So I decided to implement my dream, and I start my trainee as a lawyer. And I practiced law with my trainer, who was a good lawyer, Isa Dallal. But then I discovered that if I continue to be with him in his office, I will not be a good lawyer myself. Nobody will see me as a lawyer. So I decided to open my own office with no resources, nearly. But in 1984, I started law firm alone.
Were there other female lawyers at that time?
Or 5 before me. Now we have 22% of the total number of lawyers are female, which is a good progress.
Yeah, I was going to say, not bad. No. Yeah. Do you ever think of it in this way, that maybe your brother being born and that being putting you in that situation, that was the spark for you to sort of follow that path? Or
This was part. But generally, I was that person who is looking around with a lot of passion to know and to realize and to see and to understand. I was a reader. My father has a big library and nearly I read everything. from the very political to the very scientific books and history and whatever. Everything he had, I was reading.
Watching you, you know, follow your passion and so on, has that impacted how your brother, as a man, as a Jordanian man, sees his wife or his kids, or has that influenced him, do you think?
Yeah. One of my brothers is working with me as a gender-sensitive person. He is doing these statements. He has a degree in law as well.
Is that the one master who was degree. Born?
No, first? The one after, not the first one. The first one is living abroad in Greece now. He's an engineer. But they are dealing with their children differently, of course. They have gender-sensitive relation with their families. That's good. But still, this is a generation. I think we need 2 generations, 3 generations to see an end to the traditional practice and mentality. Totally. But my daughters, very independent, very powerful, very self-reliance, self-confidence. Also, my son is very sensitive to his wife, and they are really cooperating in taking care of their child and their home. So, yeah, I think there was a very positive impact, but not 100% what I hope to see.
What do you tell young women when you talk to them today about working, you know, trying balancing family, work life, and, you know, the challenges they face when they get out of university?
I want every woman to think of herself as a very valuable human being who have full rights to enjoy, to choose, to decide, but also ready to pay the price, which is a lot of work, a lot of responsibilities, a lot of taking risks all the time, and ready to confront the traditions and the closed mentality that is around us. So it's not easy. They should not tolerate any discrimination, any close-minded groups who are really trying to use God or use whatever to control the society. The most important thing for Jordan, I think, is to at least not allowing any backlashes. At least keep what we developed until now as achievements and build on it to go further, which is a huge responsibility in this situation. I think Jordan, despite of the problems women are facing, Jordan is a place where the opportunities is there. And if we use it the right way, and if we work with men because we don't see that this is a fight between man and woman, we see it as a fight between modernist man and woman and the conservative man and woman as well. It's a fight between the past and the future.
It's a fight between the past and the future. So much of life is, in Jordan, in the United States, in many places these days. Life has sped up and change has sped up. Ideas spread more quickly, including the idea that women deserve equal rights in all spheres. That's exciting and empowering for some people and threatening to others, who sometimes resist. So I asked Shirin what she felt after spending some time in Jordan, talking to women of different generations. Did she end up feeling that things are better for Jordanian women now than they were when Asma Khader was a girl dreaming of becoming a lawyer?
That's a really good question. No, I don't. Because from what she told me, it sounded like there were things that she had that I think some women don't have now, some freedoms that she had. Plus, I think her personal story is interesting because she had a really supportive father. And I'm wondering, if she didn't have a supportive father, would she ever be able to achieve what she did? I'm not sure if she would.
Because, she says, changing an entrenched male-dominated culture isn't easy, even when women and some men, like Asma's father, are pushing for change.
Look at Iran. Women have been to jail. They've had family members put into jail. You know, they've had to flee the country. It's not easy. You're fighting something that's so much bigger than you and an apparatus that is so much more powerful than you. But then if you come together and then you keep at it, I think you can at least make small steps, make small changes, and then it takes time. It's taken, for example, the woman in Iran 30 years to be able to wear colorful headscarves. That might seem a really tiny, small change. But for me as an Iranian, it's not. The fact that I can now go to Tehran and show off a little bit more hair than my mom used to be able to do 30 years ago, I think this is a major change and it's worth fighting for.
Because it's not really about the hair or the color of the headscarves. It's about men backing off from dictating to women how they should look and how much of them should be seen and how much they can express themselves in all ways in public, including in the workplace. It's hopeful to me to hear accomplished women of different generations, both Muslim and Middle Eastern, talk about the gains that have been made in creating more space and respect and rights for women in their societies, and the clear-eyed focus they have on what yet needs to be done in their societies and in so much of the rest of the world. That's it for this time. Thanks to Shirin Jafari for her contribution to this episode. You can hear her reporting regularly on The World, including other reporting on women in the workplace from her trip to Jordan. And you can find her past stories at PRI.org. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad. It's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. This episode and all previous episodes of Whose Century Is It? Are at PRI.org/century, which also features essays, photos, and links, so you can go a little deeper into whatever interests you. Download us wherever you get your podcasts, and if you like the podcast, subscribe. Better yet, subscribe and rate us on iTunes. And tell a friend. In fact, tell a friend about podcasts in general. A lot of people still don't know what they are or how to find them.
A message from the American Podcast Council.
Every month, 1 out of 5 Americans listens to a podcast, and that's fantastic. But friend, we can do better. All this month, we want you to find one of those 4 Americans who doesn't listen to podcasts. A friend, a relative, the only cool coworker in your office. Find that person and explain to them, slowly but gently, what a podcast is, where to find one, and then how to listen to it. When you complete that mission, tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod. That's T-R-Y pod.
And of course, this podcast, Whose Century Is It?, is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Join us next time.